Labor and Commerce will come to order. It's 3:25 p.m. on March 28, 2012. With us, we have Representative Miller, Holmes, myself, Chair Olson, Representative Johnson, Sadler, and Thompson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones, or at least put them on vibrate. Preferably turn them off. We have two items on the agenda today. The first is House Bill 275, retiree benefits, colorectal, and drug benefits. We last heard this bill on the 12th. At that time, we had a presentation and we took public testimony. Today, we have Commissioner Becky Hultberg from Admin with us. But first, I think we'll have Representative Bob Lynn and his staff, Mike Sika, give us a brief summary of the bill, and then
Sika the speaker.
We'll bring the Admin up. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee, for considering this very, very important bill again. But before we go on, it's come to my attention that there was, in fact, a 5-4 United States Supreme Court ruling this last summer that basically says that generic drug companies don't have the same level of legal responsibilities as the makers of brand name drugs. That's kind of a shock to me. Federal law mandates that generic drugs be chemically equivalent to generic drugs, or vice versa. It also requires that generic manufacturers use the same labels as brand name products, information such as drug use, dosages, risk, and so on. Now, since generic companies don't have control over their labels, the Supreme Court ruled that generic manufacturers cannot be sued for failing to alert patients about the risk beyond the federally required labeling that's on the brand name drugs. On the other hand, brand name companies, which do have control over the labels, can in fact be sued for inadequate warnings. That means that brand name drugs, that means that generic drug may be chemically the same as brand name drugs. Generic drug, chemically the same brand name drug, but the legal remedy between for any problem that comes along with that between generic and brand name are not the same. One can be sued, the other cannot. And this concerned me very much, and I wanted to alert the committee to this inequity before we go too much further with this proposed legislation. Now, I do understand the importance of the substantial savings from the use of genetics. I'm also concerned about the risk of choosing a cheaper drug with less legal remedy in the event that something goes terribly wrong. And then again, on the other hand, early detection of colorectal cancer will save lives, save needless suffering, save money, and obviously that's important too. So there you have it, Mr. Chairman and Committee. I wanted to bring this issue before you for your consideration, for your attention, and that should be part of our deliberations and what we do with this. We do need to save money, we need to save lives.
Well, you really attracted my attention when you said the Supreme Court came in with a 5-4 decision. I was thinking along the lines of
actual health care. No.
Many other.
A little premature.
A lawsuit that the state of Alaska is a participant in Washington, D.C. right now, but apparently
right.
That one hasn't been
I've heard about that.
Wrapped up. But I think hopefully we're going to find a resolution to this. Mm-hmm. That should.
Yeah, I just wanted the committee to understand this because, we shouldn't do anything with legislation to understand this.
Oh no!
Inequity. I wanted to disclose that, and it just came. I was shocked when I heard that.
Question.
Thank you,
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair. But do you have the what court case that was? The Supreme Court case,
Mr. Seeger.
Look it up and look the details.
Through the chair, I'm Mike Seeger, staff Representative Lynn. Just off the top of my head, I think it was Levine versus. I'll bring you that information. There were actually two cases they looked at. One was a generics case. One was a brand name case. And they were able to determine that there were different outcomes depending. But through the chair, if I could just point out that whether or not this bill goes through, it's an issue that exists. There are many, many states that have mandatory generic programs. There are millions and millions of generics dispensed every day with almost no problems, and although it's related to the bill, I don't think this bill significantly changes the question.
And if you could get the case numbers to Conrad, we can get them out to everybody that's on our email list and also post them on our
And Mr. Chair,
committee website.
It's my understanding that there's some talk of changing this situation through legislation in the United States Congress, and I believe during the interim, I may write a letter to our congressional delegation pointing out this inequity and asking see if they can do to change. Because no matter what happens with this personal legislation of mine, it's still an issue.
Yeah.
It's still an issue. And it's too late in the season now, but I can see possibly a resolution coming forth on this.
Okay. I spent up to 6 years working on a bill before I got it right.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
We got all the kinks out, not got it right, but got it to where it was workable. Ed, with a brief recap of the colorectal.
And basically what this bill does is two things. It extends coverage of colorectal screening, which is a preventative procedure, to our public retirees and the PERS, TERS, JERS, and retired public officers. And then the second part of the bill increases the use of generic drugs by those same beneficiaries by allowing them to choose between a brand, but the plan will not pay for it unless a doctor or pharmacist states in writing, written as prescribed, or if there is no generic equivalent. That's it.
And I think the last hearing, I guess I don't have it with me now, I don't think, some dramatic examples of the differences between brand name and generic. One, I think it was generic for Prilosec, and I think it was around $3,000-some-odd bucks for brand name for 90-day supply, and around $10 to $20 for generic.
Yeah, I believe Mike gave us a copy of the schedule, and we've added.
I just wanted to remind the committee.
Yeah, it's tough to ignore those numbers.
Yeah.
And with that, thank you, gentlemen. I think we'll bring Commissioner Hallberg up. By yourself, or would you like to bring staff, or?
Call a friend.
I'll face you by myself for now, at least.
I think she can hold
I think we're friendly.
For the record, my name's Becky Hultberg, and I'm the commissioner of the Department of Administration. And I'm going to provide a little context to you and then address the bill directly. But first, I want to say that I want to thank the sponsor of the bill for raising this issue, which I think is a very important issue. And while we may have a different approach on how we want to get to the end goal, I think our end goal is the same. And we've had some good conversations with the bill sponsor earlier in the year about this bill and expressed our appreciation at that time, too. So a little background on why I'm sitting here today. Healthcare and the cost of healthcare, I think, is probably one of the most important issues that I can address during my tenure in the Department of Administration as commissioner. Between our active and retiree plan, we spend over $500 million a year. Now, you don't see that as line items in the budgets you approve because those are costs that are built into our personnel costs in all departments, and they are part of the unfunded liability that we are working to pay off over a long period of time. So they're very real costs, but not always costs that you're going to see directly in the budgets that you pass. The retiree plan is the vast majority of the expenditures of the two plans. I can get you those exact numbers if you're interested. And the growth rates, and this is what's most concerning, the growth rates for those plans has been around 8% a year. We had a very good plan year in 2011, actually such a good plan year in 2011, that it brought the growth rate down over the last decade to 8% from over 9. So when you have healthcare costs that are growing at 8 and 9%, that's including population adjustments. Without population adjustments, it's still more around 6 or 7%. So essentially growing at double the rate of inflation, healthcare costs are going to consume more and more of the state's general fund budget if we cannot get those growth rates under control. So working to bend down the cost curve of healthcare growth is one of my primary objectives, And as I said, one of the things I think that is most important for me to focus on in the next couple of years. I believe that with good management of our two plans and working together with the Alaska provider community, that we can have an impact on those growth rates. So I want to give you a little bit of background of the retiree plan. You may have heard some of this from the bill's sponsor, and then just speak very briefly about the bill. The retiree plan was established in the 1970s. It is covered by the diminishment clause in the state constitution, which essentially says that retirement benefits cannot be diminished. The way that's been interpreted is that if you change a plan in such a way that it reduces a benefit to a retiree, that's construed as a diminishment and is thus not allowed. And so the plan has been changed very infrequently. It has been changed, and often there are court challenges, and those changes are litigated. So it can be changed, but it's a difficult process to go through. And as a result, I don't think we do not have what I would call a best-in-class modern insurance plan. Insurance plans are really meant to change and evolve as healthcare changes, as coverage changes, and as the economic environment we're in changes. With this plan, we don't really have the flexibility to adapt as we do in the active plan. So a few highlights of the plan, and some of these are things that the plan covers, and some of them are things that the plan doesn't cover. It's a very, what you would call a rich plan, if you're using some of the terminology that was used in the federal health care discussion. It's a $150 deductible, an $850 out-of-pocket max a year. There aren't many plans better than that. But preventive care is not included. It's not covered. The healthcare environment in the 70s was very different than what we know today. So it's not just colorectal screening that's not covered. If a physician preventive care visit would not be covered if it's only for the purpose of preventive care. So there are many things that this plan does not offer that are standard in a regular health care plan. Dependents to age 26 are not covered, as they are now in the active plan. We have heard a lot of feedback from retirees who would like to see dependents covered up to age 26. However, that's just an additional cost that would then become an additional unfunded liability. We can't enforce steerage. We cannot force retirees or ask retirees or penalize retirees for using our network or not using our network. That's very problematic because with a health plan, contracting is based on steerage. And so if you cannot demonstrate that you can move your volume to a particular facility, it's very difficult to get them to offer you a discount. So that's a very difficult element of this plan as well. There's a $2 million per member coverage limit. Now, I can tell you, I've looked at the numbers, and we have individuals in the retiree plan who have exceeded that $2 million coverage limit. That means they have no more health insurance. And so that is an area of the plan that we need to look at, because with a static limit, as healthcare costs grow at 6, 7, 8% a year, we're going to see more and more people hitting that $2 million coverage limit and more people who then don't have health insurance. We need to address that issue. There are no wellness services to speak of, very limited, as we talked about, no preventive care, not much in the way of proactive wellness services. It's a high-cost plan. We don't really get what I would consider good value for the dollar we spend. And as the bill sponsor has noted, there's no requirement or additional copay, which is often the case in many plans. If you choose a brand name drug, you can still fill it, but often you have to pay a higher copay. Not so for this plan. So there's no incentive built into the plan for retirees to choose generic drugs. So that's just kind of an overall look at how this plan is different than plans you might often see or be exposed to and what we need to look at. The plan needs to be modernized. But in modernizing the plan, we need to make sure that we're doing it in such a way that we're both improving health and controlling costs. That we're not just adding costs to a plan that's already very expensive. We're actually taking action to control costs and at the same time improving health. And modernizing this plan is going to require careful actuarial and legal analysis. Moving on to the bill, as I said before, I really want to thank the sponsor for raising this important issue. As you can tell, we're thinking about it. It's something that we have to do. I believe the sponsor is absolutely correct in saying that we need to add preventive services to this plan. And I think the sponsor is absolutely correct in saying we need to balance the enhancements we make to the plan with cost-saving measures so that we're getting better value for the plan. We have to do more than just the items mentioned in this bill, I think, to modernize the plan. And we can make the these changes administratively. It does not require legislation. And so my ask of you today is that we be given the opportunity to make the changes that the bill sponsor has discussed, and we would evaluate, obviously, what the bill sponsor raised about the concern over the ability with generic drugs to seek appropriate legal remedy. But we are asking that we be given the latitude to make these changes administratively as part of a broader package to modernize this health plan.
Commissioner, if I could butt in, just so I'm perfectly clear on this, you're talking about both halves, the colorectal screening and the prescriptive component.
Mr. Chairman, we have not fully evaluated the sponsor's suggestion regarding a generic drug mandate. I think we would want to do some further analysis on the generic drug mandate. Another route might be to increase co-pays for brand name drugs. I'm not sure that we would at the end of the day select that as one of the things we'd want to address or not. We need to do further analysis on that. But I can tell you that with respect to preventive care, that's an absolute must to add into the plan. And we will be adding in preventive care to this plan. We want to do it in a way where we look at the plan comprehensively, and whatever changes we make, we are balancing within the context of the legal constraints that we have. So I want to also note that we are making current changes to the active plan, which I believe many of you are members of, and I want to note some of those changes just as sort of evidence of our commitment to move forward on these retiree changes. For FY13, we're going to begin covering preventive care in the active plan at 100%. So for a preventive care visit once a year with all associated tests your physician recommends, we will be covering that at 100% with no deductible or copay. It's because we believe in the importance of preventive care. We will be covering tobacco cessation at 100%. So for individuals who smoke and want assistance to stop, we will be covering that 100%, including whatever pharmaceuticals a doctor would recommend to assist the individual in doing that. And we're changing wellness vendors, adding a more robust wellness program to the plan, which I believe will have a lot more benefits and features for plan members. So we're taking those actions on the active side. We have to take them much more carefully on the retiree side because of the legal constraints I mentioned. But we are absolutely committed to doing that, and that is one of our priorities. Following session is to begin work on what that will look like.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner. Good to see you, and happy belated birthday.
Thank you.
So I like what you've been saying. I'm very sympathetic. I understand the constraints. I know in the particular area of the colorectal screening, this is something that's been on your radar screen for a couple of years, yours and your predecessors mm-hmm. for several years. So I was just wondering if I could ask you a couple of questions about where that analysis is headed, given that unlike the generic drugs or some of the other things, you've actually been thinking about it. Would you be planning, do you know, to have that coverage as part of the general plan available to everybody, or would it be some sort of special or premium plan that it would be included in?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, there are sort of two ways you could look at this, and we have not, honestly, gotten to the point where we're ready to recommend one approach. The best and the optimal way to do it is to change the plan, just change the basic plan, mm-hmm. because there are things that I think we need to change in the plan, and we want these services available to everyone. The other option would be to create a standalone plan that's a choice for members. So if you want to get preventive care, you can choose this plan. But as part of choosing that plan, you know, perhaps you have a different, you might pay a little bit more if you go to an out-of-network provider. And I'm not saying we've decided that. I'm just using that as an example. So there are several ways you could do it. I know it's been discussed before that you could provide a package of wellness services that a retiree could purchase for an extra premium. I'm not, that's one option. I'm not sure it's the way to go, because the goal is to get people to use these services. Mm-hmm. So when you create additional cost to them to get preventive care, it becomes a barrier. Mm-hmm. So our goal is really, let's remove the barriers to preventive care, which, as you can see in the active plan, that's what we're doing. We're really trying to remove barriers to incentivize people to get preventive care. So those are three ways you could do it. I think our preference would probably be look at complete plan changes. If that's too difficult, the side-by-side would probably be the next best option. I think having them purchase wellness services for additional premium would be third on the list.
And if I may continue, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Along those same lines, have you thought about whether this would be subject to the same limitations as other services, or whether there would be any dollar cap or additional deductibles or additional copays? I mean, you addressed that a little bit, but have you thought about any of those specifics?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, our initial approach, and this is without the benefit of some of the detailed analysis we would need to do, would be to just provide this within the context of the regular coverage and not to assess any additional deductibles or copays. As I said before, really, when you're looking at good plan management, you want to incentivize people to get primary care, mm-hmm. and you want to incentivize people to get preventive care. You want to provide not necessarily barriers, but disincentives to use care inappropriately. As an example, we don't have this element in either of our plans, but some plans do, where if you go to the emergency room for a non-emergent visit, for a non-emergent issue, you might have an extra $100 copay. Now, that's not something we have in our plans, and I'm not suggesting we add it in. I'm just saying that when you look at managing a plan, you want to provide incentives for appropriate care pathways. You want to provide, I guess, barriers, for lack of a better term, for inappropriate use of care.
Mr. Chairman, the Commissioner and I are right on the same page. I come from the Chicago School, which is all about writing policies and laws that encourage the behavior you want to see and discourage the behavior you don't want to see. So in that direction, I doubt you're going to see a lot of pushback from me. If I may, just two more quick follow-ups. One is, while you're looking at this, are you considering having the screening tests be covered? I understand there are national guidelines that talk about mm-hmm. what tests, and some jurisdictions might choose to only cover some certain tests, but maybe not the full spectrum of recommended tests. Have you done any research on that?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, yes, and I'm aware of it's the U.S. Preventive Care Task Force, I believe, if I could be saying that wrong, has come up with the recommended list of preventive tests, and we've looked at that list. And as we go forward, we'll be considering whether or not just to adopt the recommendations of that or the coverage for the services on that list going forward. We weren't quite ready to take that step yet in the active plan, but we will be looking at that going forward, and certainly looking to apply those concepts to the retiree plan. I think we're going to begin taking a much more active role with respect to our health plans, and really trying to work on how can we, through our plan, get people to a better health status, mm-hmm. which I think is really the goal of a plan. It's not just to provide coverage when they get sick. That's an important reason to have insurance, but it's also to, how do we get people to a better health status?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I'm going to have one more question before I do that. This is obviously an issue that we were just in. It seems like half the committees I sit on, we come back to the rising cost of health care, and I sit on the HES budget subcommittee and have for 6 years, and so we are in charge of overlooking the Medicaid budget, and you just see it go up and up and up. And so trying to figure out ways to make people healthier, make them more productive, less lost work, happier, healthier people into old age, and also control the costs, I'm very sympathetic. And I think it's obviously also a problem in the private sector. It's a problem nationwide. I guess my last question is, do you have any thoughts at this point on the timing? The bill, of course, would put a certain timeline on you. You're asking us not to go that route, instead to let you do it on your own timeline. What would be your timeline for hopefully implementing the colorectal screening?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, I don't have a specific timeline that I can give you right now, other than to say that it's one of our department's highest priorities. We've had a lot of conceptual discussions. We have an RFP right now out for health management consultants, and one of the reasons for putting that RFP out and getting a health management consultant on board was to assist us in making plan changes for our active and retiree plans. So the retiree plan is our first priority. I would suggest that we would probably have it a draft plan easily by, you know, within several months after session, or certainly before next session. What I can't speak to is legal analysis that needs to be done on the plan and the actuarial analysis that needs to be done. Both of those can be time-consuming. I mean, obviously, my goal is to get this done as quickly as possible. I think we've made a commitment to do it, and I think it's important. And so I can speak more to our process that we'll go through, but without being able to give you timelines on how the actuarial, how long it will take to do the actuarial piece and the legal piece, I hesitate to give you a specific date.
Thank you.
I'm going to cut in line, I guess is my prerogative. But if we choose this path, and I might add, I've been chair of Labor and Commerce for 6 years, and only one other time have I had the administration come before the committee with an offer like this, and it was on a personnel issue, and they delivered, and it was much cleaner than had we pursued the legislation. But hypothetically, if we go down this path, would you most likely be able to have something by late fall that we would be able to meet during the interim as a committee and at least get the ball rolling so we can have something that we could put out at the beginning of session and do whatever we have to do on this side? Is that reasonable that we could have it by fall?
Mr. Chairman, I think if there's a desire for this committee to stay engaged in this process, we'd certainly welcome that, and certainly by this fall, I think we'd be able to share with you whether it's a draft plan, how far we are with that. I definitely think we'd have a work product to share with you. Again, I think we can just make these changes can be made administratively by I'm technically the plan administrator, so I can make these plan changes. Because of the significance of the retiree plan and the constraints involved in managing that plan, obviously we want to make sure we are doing this in a way that, I mean, when we're making changes to this plan, in some ways they're forever changes. And so we just need to do that very cautiously. So certainly I would commit to you that we'd have a work product by the fall that we could discuss with you and where you could assess our progress.
And as a follow-up, it's my understanding, I'm sure I'll be able to tell by the nodding of the head which way heads are nodding in the room, but part of the problem with the current situation that we've had on colorectal is a portion of it depends on how the doctor submits the bill. So you could have somebody that was paid fully and another person who had exactly the same situation, but the doctor presented in a different manner and it was denied.
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct. And what's happening in some cases, if the physician submits the claim as a purely preventive care measure, that this is, you know, important, we all know that when you're over 50, it's, you know, time to get a colonoscopy, and if you just go in and say, I'm healthy, I have no problems, I need a, this is purely for preventive care, and that's the way it's coded, it will not be covered. However, if it's coded as diagnostic for purposes, because there's a concern that there may be something wrong, then it's covered, because it's then a medical procedure and not a preventive. And so, you know, absolutely, that's not a tenable situation and certainly not the position we want to put our retirees or our medical community in. So, again, you have my commitment that we are going to fix this issue. It's a complicated one, and it will take a bit of time, but my hope is that we can get on this quickly, that we can make the changes that we need to make, and that we can improve this plan, because really that's where we need to be on the whole host of issues that I mentioned to you, the coverage, the $2 million coverage limit, just general preventive care. I mean, we need to modernize this plan.
One last question. Would it be safe to assume that this is your highest priority of the two would be the colorectal? And the
rather than the generics,
because we probably do have people dying from not being screened early, as opposed to taking a generic drug instead of a
Mr. Chairman, absolutely, and I would say that it's not just colonoscopy, because this bill is narrow in the fact that it covers colorectal screening. But right now we're in a situation where if you go in just purely for preventive care for a number of things, it's not covered. And so that's just not an optimal situation. We want people to go in if they have high blood pressure. We want it diagnosed. If they have high cholesterol, we want it diagnosed. And so the preventive care aspect of this plan and changing that is absolutely our highest priority. We do want to be able, though, when we do this, because of that issue with the diminishment clause, if there are some plan changes we make that can improve quality and lower cost, we want to be able to have the ability to make those at the same time.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A number of my questions have been addressed, I guess, but real quick, you said that, Commissioner Hultberg, that your preferred approaches were to first rework the main retiree health care plan as you described here. Second was to do a side-by-side offer, one option, the status quo, and one different. What was the third one again?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, one option has been to provide a package of benefits, preventive care benefits that a retiree could purchase for an additional, they don't pay, most of them don't pay a premium, but for a premium amount. And again, my concern about that is really that we want to remove barriers to preventive care, and cost can be a barrier.
Gotcha. Okay. And it's like a rider or a sidebar, a supplementary policy kind of thing. Okay. And given that there is no effective date clause, even if we pass this, it would take place a certain amount of time. I'm going to ask the question, what's the downside of actually having these things in law as opposed to waiting for you to do, if that's what you decide electronic should do, having it in regulation?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think the downside is that it's important when you're looking at a health plan to look at all elements of it together. And if we just start looking at one element here and one element there, we're not making the kinds of changes to the plan that are going to have the real impact that we want to see. Alongside that, adding in things like preventive care is an enhancement to the plan. If we want to do some other things to help us manage our costs, if we can't add enhancements in, we must add enhancements in if we're doing things on the other side that could be considered as diminishments. And so by adding enhancements through legislation, it reduces our ability to make some other adjustments that could save us costs without compromising the quality health care that retirees get.
And another follow-up, I do applaud the sponsor for bringing this this issue forward. Obviously, it's gotten the juices flowing, people thinking about this. And a question that might not be fair to ask you to speak for your predecessors, but why has no one addressed the preventative and wellness and cost containment elements of the retiree health care program before this?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I can't answer that question. I just really don't know. But as I came into this role and began looking at healthcare costs, and as Representative Holmes had mentioned, Commissioner Struer and I have worked very closely together and have even gone out and done several presentations on just the overall impact of healthcare costs to the state and the rising cost of those services. It just became very hot. It rose very quickly to be one of my top priorities within the department.
I think I can add something on this. A portion of this bill has been before us, I believe, twice in the past few years, and it was strictly colorectal, and it had a significant fiscal note because there was no offset like the one proposed by the sponsor of the bill. I think the fact that he came in with something that was more balanced made the possibility that we could go in this direction more feasible. And with the direction that the commissioner is talking about, doing it almost on a holistic basis makes a lot more sense, at least to me. And I think that's why the bill died in the previous versions. It was narrow, and it wasn't looking at the total picture. It was looking at a problem, but not the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Holmes, were you waving your hand?
I was not, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions for the commissioner while we have her at the table?
It certainly does play out.
That's why, yeah. Through the chair, Representative Commissioner Holford, how closely do you think, you said earlier that the plan for active state employees is pretty flexible. It's not bound by the diminishment clause and so forth. How closely would you envision the retiree plan ending up looking like the active state employee plan at the end of the process you described?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, let me speak to what the ideal world is and then what's real. In an ideal world, we have a best-of-class plan. I mean, we look at what is evidence-based best practice, and that's what we implement. Now, we have this thing called the Constitution that we need to be very mindful of that may present somewhat of a barrier to that. And so I'm not suggesting that we're going to have plans that are completely aligned, because when you look at the cost, the differences in cost to the member right now, mm-hmm. it's significantly less for the retiree plan. I don't know that would change significantly. So they're likely never to be completely aligned. But I think we should get more alignment on things that are best practice in plan management, and certainly things that are best practice in health overall health management. And that would include things. I mean, we should have alignment on things like preventive care. There should not be a reason we have differences. We should have, I think, more alignment on things like networks and our ability to encourage people to use networks, because that's just basic. It's just a basic part of being able to effectively manage a health plan. And so I think we'd like to see more alignment. In an ideal world, we'd have complete alignment. I don't think we'll get there, but on certain elements, I think we are going to work toward better alignment.
Thanks again, Commissioner.
Thank you.
We had set this up as invitation only for testimony today, and we only have two people online that have testified on several occasions, but I would be remiss if I didn't invite Pat Luby up to the table if he would care to make a few comments on it. I'm sure you can see the direction that we're probably going to be going on, and I think I know you well enough to put you on the spot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Luby. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP. We're obviously very concerned about making sure that retirees who are under the age of 65 get that preventive care that the Commissioner was talking about. Medicare now recognizes that this is a good idea. They put 19 different preventive aspects into the Medicare program. They're not doing that because they like older people. They're doing it because it makes good public health sense and it does save money. I think the commissioner's coming up with a good plan. We certainly would support it. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming down today. It was a pleasant surprise. And, I also know how old Pat is, so we share a pretty much common birthday. We're not as old as the sponsor of the bill, though.
As wise.
With that, I'm going to close out, officially close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee for discussion. Again, the only time I've had an offer made by the administration like this in 6 years, they came through with something that was palatable, and it was on a issue where we had some people fall through the cracks, a class of employee firefighters, and we were able to do an administrative fix that was much more timely and efficient and broader than what we had proposed in legislation, and that's the only time I've had an offer like this before the committee, and it would be my recommendation that we give with the sponsor's consent. You want to join us at the table and weigh in on this? You can sit up here. If
this will work just fine. Mm-hmm. I said that side too often.
Well, I'm very pleased overall at the direction this entire process has taken. Obviously, I like the bill. I think the best part of the bill I put forward is the fact that it's brought this to everybody's attention. There's a great disparity between costs between generic drugs and brand name drugs. We already talked about that. We know all the benefits of early screening for colorectal cancers. The object, for me at least, is not just to pass a bill and tack a medal on the wall that I passed the bill, but to solve the problem. And the problem needs to be solved, whether we do it through legislation, which is one path, or do it through administrative action, which is another path. As long as we get the problem solved, that's what I'm looking at. And as best as I could hear over there, we have a pretty firm commitment from the administration that they're going to move forward with this. They've heard the testimony, all sides of this. The thing I brought before you today on generic versus brand name drugs, the Supreme Court thing, my office will be doing some correspondence on that and possibly a resolution at some point in the future by me or somebody. And I want to thank the committee and the administration for all this. I think we've moved forward quite a ways on this, and I'm happy with the result.
Well, it's my intent, too, to have a hearing this fall on both issues. By then, the commissioner should be in good shape to tell us.
Excellent. I hope to be there.
He's going on that, and we can explore what we can do, too, on the drug issue.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, committee.
So, unless I see any opposition, I'm going to hold this bill. And I think you're ultimately, Representative Glenn, going to end up with something you can hang on your wall.
A lot of people are like hanging on a wall.
Hope they're not in this room.
And Mr. Chairman, he doesn't have to go to finance.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
So with that, we'll hold it over. And the last item on the calendar today is Senate Bill 125. Come on up, Bob.
Thanks again,
Representative, Commissioner, mm-hmm. Pat.
Thanks, Becky.
So nice.
Shouldn't they all work their way?
When you said
we're having trouble pulling up the bills.
Huh. Yeah, it could be the. Welcome back. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And
yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Pawlowski, staff to Senator Kevin Meyer, and here to speak on Senate Bill 125, the Auto Dealers Practices Act bill. And I'll open by the senator sends his regrets to the committee as a conflict.
And he was here for the first time when we had the brief presentation. Time. But yeah, if you could just walk it through us real quick, we will.
We sure will. You've heard this bill. Senate Bill 125 is a consumer protection bill to protect and assist consumers in finding and purchasing competitively priced motor vehicles that are offered in prices that are clearly stated by the dealers. Senate Bill 125 updates the statutes referred to as the Alaska Auto Dealers Practices Act, clarifying several provisions concerning the advertising of new and used automobiles. The revisions assist consumers in understanding auto comparison pricing and eliminates ambiguities contained in the current statutes. It assists the dealers in following state law, a very key element that came in the drafting. Senate Bill 125 was drafted in conjunction with the Department of Law to provide protection for the consumer in purchasing the motor vehicle and fairness to the dealers in pricing and advertising the vehicle. Simply, and throughout this, we have to provide compliments to the auto dealers and to Ed Sniffen in particular in the Department of Law for their close work together in crafting these changes.
And I'm sure the committee will remember the House version of this that we heard several weeks ago. And we do have Ed Sniffen online, and we've got Steve. I'm going to butcher your last name. Elwin?
You're close.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman.
Your writing's similar to mine.
Sir.
I won't insult you by. It's almost illegible, but. So we do have people on question. And with that, is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there anybody online other than Ed Sniffen for questions? With that, we'll close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee for discussion. Any changes since 3 weeks ago?
Well, my question is the Senate bill the same as the?
Yes.
Are they identical?
Yeah.
Are things the same? So the testimony we took then is we can go to the bank on. Okay, that's my only question. You know those senators, they'll sneak stuff in on you.
Yeah.
Well, just in case, I think Representative Miller would like to ask Ed Sniffen at least one question or two. Or
if I can remember it, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what I was concerned with, and I have had some conversations with folks representing the Automobile Dealers Association, and I think I have the clarity, but I want to make sure that, that I understand this. Ed, are you with us? I just want to confirm.
Yes, I am, sir. Thank you, yes.
Okay, thank you, sir. So the question is for you, when a consumer walks onto a car lot looking for a vehicle and they have an advertised price on the window, if they decide they want to pay that price, they're finished. Is that correct? I mean, that's it. You basically take that price, you go to the finance office, and you're done.
Ed, could you state your name and affiliation for the record?
Yes, I will, Mr. Chairman. Ed Sniffen with the Department of Law in Anchorage. And, yes, Representative, that is correct. If you see an advertised price on a vehicle on a lot, you can go into the lot, pay that price, and you're done. And that advertised price needs to include everything that the consumer would have to pay except for fees paid to a government entity, so title registration, if there are taxes, for example, in your community, you would pay those in addition to that price. But other than those things, yes, that is correct.
And now, is this, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I'll follow on. Is this the same set of criteria, whether it's a new car or a used car? Is there any distinction between those two categories?
Through the chair, Representative, there is not. If an auto dealer, and auto dealer is defined to include both new and used car dealers, have an advertised price for a vehicle, that advertised price, you know, must include everything other than fees actually paid to you know, a government entity or a third party.
Can you give me an example of a third party?
Through the chair, again, Representative, it would be mostly, I'm trying to think of something that wouldn't fall in this category, but mostly it would be a government entity, the Department of Motor Vehicles, for title, licensing, and registration. And those would be the only things I can think of off the top of my head that a dealer could add on to that advertised price.
Okay, and then if I should opt, you know, when I'm sitting in the finance office, I should want some winterizing or, you know, a battery blanket or undercoating or any of these other things, or a certain credit union I want to be financed through that may or may not have a higher or lower rate, that's entirely options up to me, correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. The advertised price would be for the vehicle as advertised, and if, you know, it didn't include those things and you wanted to add them, yes, those would be at your own expense, as would extended service contracts, for example, or, you know, other items that you might want to add on to the vehicle that are not included, you know, in that advertised price.
All right. Now I'm going to get into more of the root of what I was after. Can you define what dock fees are?
Yes, through the chair, a doc fee is sort of a shorthand acronym for a document preparation fee, and that is a fee motor vehicle dealers typically add on to the price of a vehicle that compensates them for preparing the paperwork necessary to get this vehicle titled and licensed. It is not a government fee. It's generally largely an item of overhead that the dealer absorbs in order to make the car ready for driving off their lot. To capture that that effort, they charge a dock fee. And around Anchorage, for example, that fee typically ranges from, you know, $100 to $200. In some rare cases, I've seen it as high as, you know, $300. But it's generally in that range.
Okay. And where would I discover that particular fee? Is that going to be on a sticker? Is that added later, as we discussed with those other government fees, etc.? When am I, as the consumer, going to be aware of that?
Through the chair, current statutes require that the dock fee be included in any advertised price for a vehicle. So you should see if the dealer wishes to disclose it, if the advertised price must include that fee. So if they try to add that fee onto the advertised price at a later time, that would be in violation of the statute. Now, if you go into a dealership and you decide to negotiate a different price for the motor vehicle, let's say the vehicle is listed at $29,000 and you say, well, I'll give you $25,000 for it. Well, now you are working in a little different realm. Now you're negotiating a price with the dealer. And because the price you negotiate isn't the price that the dealer advertised, our current statute does not restrict the ability of the dealer to add a doc fee back into the negotiated price, with one caveat. And I would say that if you only negotiated a $100 discount and the dealer added $200 in a doc fee onto the price so the total price would exceed the advertised price, we would have an issue with that. The total price, I think, under any scenario, could not exceed the advertised price, even with the addition of a doc fee.
You anticipated my question. Thank you. And you gave me the answer that I also got from the dealers, who indicated that whatever it is you do, their advertised price is the ceiling, and I'm more than satisfied. Thank you.
Yes, anytime. Thank you.
Any further questions for Ed? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ed, brief question kind of about used car sales. Is there any provision in law requiring a dealer who sells new and used cars to provide a blue book to make it available to a customer so he can check the value of his trade-in? In other words, if he's going to bring in his old car to trade in for a new car, this law would provide that he would be able to inspect the blue book for the value of his new car. Is there any provision that requires him to make that same information available to evaluate his used car?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, currently, no, there is not. I believe most consumers, and I'm speculating there, so I shouldn't say that, but I think a number of consumers, you know, do that research ahead of time, go in there, although we do get complaints in our office from consumers who have not done that and feel like they've been cheated. But right now, no, there is no requirement that dealers make that available. And I think under the provisions of this bill, that would be a requirement, that if the dealer was going to actually use a blue book value as a price comparison, for example, in an advertisement, he would have to make that information available to the consumer.
Is that just for new, or is that also cover used?
Well, through the chair, Representative, that's a good question. I think the way the statute is written now, it would just be for used cars, because currently, for new motor vehicles, dealers are allowed to engage in price comparisons to the MSRP, which is posted on every vehicle. So there isn't really that kind of a need to do the kind of price checking that you would normally do with a blue book, although I do understand the blue book values do list prices for new vehicles as well. But most of that pricing information is already available for new vehicles on the window sticker for a new vehicle.
Follow-up in the same area. I know that you can go to the public library and get copies of old blue books from past years, and I think it's a subscription service that NADA or Kelly's does, and it's got to be current. Old cars, used cars, there's not that much difference, but I'm just kind of thinking out loud if it might be advisable to try and change this bill in some form to allow that same access for evaluation of used cars, but I'm just thinking out loud now. No.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Was that a question for me?
Nope. That's why I said no question. Just thinking out loud. So nope.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Thank you, Representative.
I think you're off the hook, Ed. Thanks a lot. Did that close our public testimony?
No, but you can do it again.
Is there anybody online? Nobody online, and nobody else in the room that cares to testify. Public testimony is closed out. Bill's back before the committee. Any discussion or thoughts or motions?
Mr. Chairman, I could see a look of disgust on the representative from Fairbanks when he found out he had to pay for his 8-track tape in his car.
Yeah. Actually, I have a turntable.
Oh, turntable. Actually, I have one of those ones. Mr. Speaker, if there's no other smart comments to be made, would you entertain a motion?
I certainly would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Senate Bill number 125 out of committee with individual recommendation attached, zero fiscal.
Seeing no opposition, the bill moves out of committee, and we're adjourned at 4:20.